Thanks for joining us. I'm Laura Kanoy of New Hampshire Public Radio, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's on vacation. 10 years ago, this week, the U.S. went to war in Afghanistan. Since that time, more than 1,700 American soldiers have lost their lives. Public support for the costly war is fading, and a new Pew Center survey finds that just one-third of post-9/11 veterans thinks the war has been worth fighting. Joining me in the studio to talk about the war in Afghanistan and the future of U.S. involvement in the region, David Kilcullen of Caris Associates. David is the former senior counterinsurgency advisor to General David Petraeus in Iraq. He's also a 20-year veteran of the Australian Army. And David, it's really nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Lieutenant General David Barno, senior advisor at the Center for New American Security and former commander of U.S. and coalition forces in Afghanistan from 2003 to 2005. And General Barno, it's really nice to see you too. Thanks for being here.
Laura, great to be here.
Also joining us from the NPR studio in New York is Jonathan Steele, former chief correspondent for The Guardian, author of the forthcoming book, Ghosts of Afghanistan, The Haunted Battleground. And Jonathan, I went through the book. Congratulations on it, and thanks for being with us this hour.
Well, thank you for taking me on.
Well, and we'll also take your comments and questions at 1-800-433-8850 or email to drshow@wamu.org, or you can join us on Facebook or Twitter. And gentlemen, just taking a big step back, here we are, 10 years. I'll turn to you first, General Barno, since you were deeply involved in Afghanistan. What has the U.S. achieved there?
Well, it's notable, I think, since the towers fell here on the 11th of September 2001, we immediately turned our attention to the source of those attacks in Afghanistan. And I think the biggest successes we've seen in the ensuing years are essentially the destruction of the Taliban regime, which harbored al-Qaeda, who were the sources of that attack, which killed almost 3,000 Americans here in the United States itself, and the elimination of the Taliban regime. We now have a democratically elected government, although flawed, certainly in Kabul. We have 5 million Afghan kids in school. 1 million of those are girls. There were zero girls in school at that time. There were about 50 kilometers of paved roads in Afghanistan back in 2001. There's somewhere around 8,000-plus kilometers today. But I think most importantly, the United States is more secure because al-Qaeda has been, in many ways, if not crushed, certainly put on their back foot and disrupted in some pretty severe ways. And our efforts in Afghanistan have been central in that.
What do you think we haven't achieved, General Barno?
Well, we certainly haven't stamped out the Taliban insurgency. When I was there from 03 to 05, the levels of violence in the country were very, very minor. There were virtually no roadside bombs. There were no suicide attacks.
Really?
It was a very, very different place. But we saw in the ensuing years, probably starting in the spring of 06, the Taliban escalating every year with more and more attacks, more and more violence, the introduction of roadside bombs, of suicide attacks. In the U.S. and then later NATO never really escalated and responded to that until here in the last 18 to 24 months. So we had a period of time there where the Taliban, in a sense, had free rein to continue to increase their attacks for almost 3 years before we responded.
And free rein to continue, why is that, David Barno? Were we distracted by Iraq? That's the line that you often hear.
That's certainly part of it. I think as I was leaving Afghanistan in May of 05, we were announcing that we were turning over the Afghan effort to NATO, to our alliance in Europe, and we announced later that year we were withdrawing 2,500 combat troops in December of 2005. We rescinded that decision, but that sent the message that the United States was moving for the exits. And I think all of the players in the region began to recalculate their plan based upon an Afghanistan that had the United States out of the action. And so I think that in a lot of ways contributed to the Taliban's resurgence. I think a lot of players reinvested in the Taliban as a hedge against what was going to come next.
And David Kilcullen, jumping on to what General Barno said, what have we achieved in Afghanistan after 10 years and what haven't we achieved?
I would agree with the general that we've done a huge amount in terms of reconstruction and development for some aspects of Afghan society. I also think we've done rather well in the counterterrorism aspect of neutralizing and reducing the threat from al-Qaeda. And we've done pretty well in dealing with the insurgency, actually. I think the general's being a little bit modest there in terms of certainly his achievements at the time, and some of the work that we've done in the last year or so has been extremely effective. Where I think we've done badly and continue to do badly are in the three things which unfortunately I think are much more important than that military success. Firstly, we really failed in the 2001 to 2003 timeframe to go through a proper reconciliation and peacemaking process in Afghanistan.
The day two issue.
Yeah.
Okay, you invade day one, what do you do day two?
Yeah, and how do you actually put that society back together or help people get to a point where they can deal with their issues in a non-violent manner? And we didn't really enable or achieve that. Secondly, we still have not really been able to stand up a viable, legitimate, responsive, an effective government in Afghanistan. And that means that while the military piece is going, frankly, rather well right now, it's difficult to see where we go from here if we can't actually stand up that viable government. And thirdly, there is just such a incredibly large degree of corruption and abuse now in some aspects of Afghan society that even if we were to successfully destroy every last insurgent tonight so that there was no Taliban tomorrow morning, it's quite likely that a new Taliban would grow in another few months because the Taliban isn't the problem. The Taliban is a symptom of a bigger set of issues. So on the whole, I think we've done if you take a 10-year view, I think we've done a great job with some aspects, but it's difficult to see how it comes out well from here.
Well, and Jonathan Steele, I want to go to you, but just real quick, David, you piqued my interest. The Taliban, if you got rid of them tomorrow, another group like them would sprout up. You called them a symptom of larger issues. Like what?
Well, I see the war as a cycle of instability rather than a classic insurgency. In a counterinsurgency model, you think, well, the insurgency is the problem. If we get rid of the insurgency, the problem goes away. That's actually not how I see the situation in Afghanistan. I see a pattern of corruption, some of it fueled by drugs, but a lot of it fueled by our own aid money, actually, which enables and incentivizes abuse on the part of power brokers and some officials of the government. That creates this incandescent rage amongst substantial parts of the population against the government, but also against us because it's our sponsored government as the international community. And then that enables and provides support for insurgents, not just the Taliban, but a wide variety of different groups. And the instability that they create creates opportunities for corruption. And that's the cycle that we have to break if we want to actually put this thing to bed.
Well, and Jonathan Steele, in your book, Ghost of Afghanistan, The Haunted Battleground, you take the long view, not just a decade, but 30 years of Afghanistan from the Soviet invasion and what happened in the years on out. Where do you see this U.S. effort now, Jonathan, after a decade of fighting in Afghanistan?
Well, I think it's basically a stalemate. And as you point out, my book really goes back 30 years. I covered the Soviet war. I was three times in Kabul when the Soviets were there, and I saw what they were doing. And I think the haunting is the fact that the same mistakes they made are now haunting the United States. And there are some intriguing differences, which we can come on to later, between the two issues. But essentially, the Russians got themselves into a stalemate. They could clear ground, but they could never hold it. And I think the problem now is that the United States administration is completely divided. The CIA, according to its latest assessments, as we understand this summer, used the phrase stalemate repeatedly, but that's not the line that their boss, General David Petraeus, was using when he was still in charge in Afghanistan. And so I think the White House is divided on that. I mean, the point was that the Russians use the same strategy, really, as the Americans are using now, which is, I call, a garrison strategy. You hold the cities, you keep the communications going on the main roads between the cities, and then you try and push out into the countryside and take a little bit of ground here and there as much as you can. But the point is, at some point, you have to leave it. You can't be there forever. And I'd just like to quote to you what Marshal Sergei Akhramayev, who was the chief of the General Staff, told the Politburo in November 1986. He said, after 7 years in Afghanistan, there is not one square kilometer left untouched by a boot of a Soviet soldier. But as soon as they leave a place, the enemy returns and restores it all back the way it used to be. And his defense minister, Marshal Sergei Sokolov, a few months later said this war cannot be won militarily. And I think the U.S. is in the same position. It cannot win this war. It has to move to some kind of negotiated settlement because the insurgents are there because the Americans are there. Most of them are fighting for patriotic reasons to get rid of the foreigners. There are other issues as well, but basically it is the presence of the Americans and the British and the other coalition forces that increases the insurgency. And I thought it was very interesting in the Pew survey that you mentioned just now. 51%, one of the figures was that 51% of the veterans, the post 9/11 veterans, think that the over-reliance on military force creates hatred that breeds more terrorism. In other words, the whole thing's been counterproductive. Al-Qaeda may have been dispersed from Afghanistan, but it has more people working with it and being trained in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia, in North Africa, and so on. So all that's happened is that Al-Qaeda has been pushed out of one safe haven into three or four others that it now has.
So this garrison strategy that you talk about, Jonathan, what strategy should have been employed, in your opinion, instead of soldiers, you know, hold up in their garrisons and then once they leave, insurgents take over again?
Well, I think it has to be a government of national unity. And I think I agree with David Kilcullen, who said that at the beginning, in the first years after the toppling of the Taliban, not enough was done in reconciliation. You could even go back to the Bonn conference of December 2001, when the Taliban had been pushed out of Kabul. They were still in Kandahar at that stage. The Pashtuns were really excluded from that Bonn conference. And so there's a real sense in the southern part of, and eastern part of Afghanistan, where most of the Pashtun live, that their political position is no longer accepted, that they've been marginalized. And a lot of people, by the way, Pashtuns were ethnically cleansed from different parts of Afghanistan in the north and the west, where they used, pockets of them used to live. So there was a real grievance there, and it wasn't addressed, and it's still there, because even though Karzai himself is a Pashtun, we know that the Afghan National Army is a majority Tajik and Uzbek army. And so when they come into Helmand and Kandahar and so on to try and take over from the Americans and the British, they are still perceived as a foreign force by the Pashtun. So
really?
The garrisons may be still there, but instead of being American and British sitting there, other foreigners, Tajiks and Uzbeks, are sitting there.
We're not appreciating those tribal differences, you're saying, Jonathan. Let me jump in and just remind you that this is the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to take a short break, but then we'll start taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. Coming up, more on 10 years of the U.S. war in Afghanistan. Welcome back. I'm Laura Kanoy, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking about the 10-year anniversary of the U.S. war in Afghanistan this hour on the Diane Rehm Show. And let's hear from you. 1-800-433-8850 is the number. You can send email to drshow@wamu.org. Our guests are David Kilcullen, president and CEO of Caris Associates, former senior counterinsurgency advisor to General David Petraeus in Iraq. Also with us, Lieutenant General David Barno, senior advisor at the Center for New American Security, and former commander of U.S. and coalition forces in Afghanistan from 03 to 05. Also joining us from New York, Jonathan Steele, former chief correspondent for The Guardian and author of the forthcoming book, Ghosts of Afghanistan, The Haunted Battleground. And gentlemen, I want to add another voice into our conversation now. Joining us by phone from Fort Belvoir, Virginia, is Fernando Lujan. He's a U.S. Army Special Forces major. And Fernando Lujan, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, and you wrote an article in the New York Times just recently, an opinion piece, recently titled, "This War Can Still Be Won." Why do you feel that way, Major Lujan?
Well, thank you very much, first off, for having me on the show. I really just want to inject a little bit of perspective from my place on the ground. I've just returned from Afghanistan. I spent about 14 months there. And the job I was doing was sort of unique in that we were going around wearing Afghan uniforms embedded in Afghan units in all the areas that we just heard people talk about, down in Helmand and down in Kandahar and Oruzgan and in Zabul, to try to get a behind-the-veil sort of perspective of what is really going on in the Afghan National Security Forces. You know, how are they operating, even when coalition forces aren't there and it's just a team of two or three of us? operating there, and really, you know, how have things changed over the past years? And I really appreciate Jonathan Steele's comments there, because I'd like to actually challenge a couple of those from the perspective I had. The piece where we said that the Army can clear but can't hold, I think that has really significantly changed over the past couple of years. I think it really doesn't come down to coalition forces holding those areas. You're right. I mean, we can go in and we can clear and we can leave, and the minute we leave, the Taliban comes back in. But what is starting to happen now in Kandahar and in Helmand is that we've gone to these places, but we are now starting to see a much more professionalized Afghan National Army, Afghan National Civil Order Police going in these places and able to hold onto the ground and build a connection with the population. And I mean, I'll just give one little story here. I mean, there's a place in Oruzgan that I had the chance to visit, a valley that really no coalition forces could even really drive into without being shot up. And just this past year, they had a big clearing operation, came in there and established contact with the locals, and started working a program called the Afghan Local Police, where essentially a special forces team comes into the village and gets the buy-in from the local leaders there in the village to live there inside and to be really villagers and to recruit local policemen from that area, right? And what they were able to do was to get buy-in from the senior village leaders, and for them to give up, you know, hey, this is my first son or my second son, you know, and he will be part of your security force. And in some ways, those local security forces could even be more valuable than the Afghan National Army, because they come from that neighborhood. I mean, they grew up in that village, and so they know who is who, you know, who belongs here and who doesn't. And even having, you know, one of those guys might be better than having 10 foreign, you know, Afghan National Army guys present in the village. And we were able to see that with just a small investment in personnel there and buy-in from the Afghan community, they were able to keep the Taliban out, you know. And it wasn't a matter, it was anything really dramatic. There was, you know, the senior Taliban from Pakistan essentially said, hey, you know, don't worry about it, you know, we've seen them clear this valley before. But after they were there for 2, 3, 4 weeks, you know, you started to hear, hey, this is what's going on, is something different here, you know, why are they staying, why have they not left? And then finally they pulled away, and the local Taliban, the people that, you know, were from the villages there, essentially switched their alliances, you know. And I remember sitting in Ashura and seeing local villagers there and having one of the special forces sergeants tell me, hey, you see that guy and that guy and that guy? You know, those are local Taliban. You know, we know they were shooting at us last year, but they're willing to play ball now. They know why we're here, they know what we're doing, and they support the local security effort here. And so those alliances are going. That is something that, you know, is potentially sustainable, because it comes from the Afghans, not from us.
Success on the ground, then, from the Afghans. So this concept, Major Luhan, of national unity versus ethnic loyalty, you're seeing a sense among the soldiers that you worked with, a growing sense of we're all Afghans.
That's absolutely correct. That is something that I think, I mean, in all candor, I came in not really knowing what to expect, right? I knew, I mean, I'd been to Afghanistan previously, last time was in 06, and I knew that it was a very heavily Tajik organization. But coming in now, I mean, really having the time to spend time with probably on the order of 20 different Afghan battalions in the field, it's not that same sense. I mean, I see these guys, and there, you know, there are Tajiks and Uzbeks and Hazaras, but there's also a growing number of Pashtuns being integrated into the conventional Afghan National Army units, right? And there were some battalions where I saw upwards of 40 or 50% Pashtun soldiers, and then among the officers, less, but still a growing number, I'd say between 20 and 25%. And more importantly, he said, hey, you know, I heard Mr. Steele's comment about, hey, we're seen as foreigners, we're rejected by, you know, that the Afghan National Army is rejected. I don't see the same thing. I see a lot of the key leadership positions, particularly the corps commander positions, are being filled by Pashtuns, right? And those are really the symbolic leaders. I mean, they know this is the commander. This is the guy that controls this entire Afghan National Army force. And, you know, General Hamid, General Maluk, the two generals for the corps down in Helmand and Kandahar are Pashtuns, and they're seeing that, and they're the primary interface with a lot of the governmental leaders in that area. So they're coming together. I mean, and it's a multi-ethnic coalition there.
Major Luhan, one last question for you, please. So based on your experiences on the ground, embedded with Afghan forces, what's the way forward for the United States in this conflict?
Well, I think the way forward is the way that we're proceeding, frankly. I think that there, while the surge has accomplished many of its purposes in giving us some breathing room, right, and letting these units have a little space to develop, I think now that the gradual, responsible withdrawal of forces down on the tactical and operational level, actually, there's a lot of opportunity there. And the reason I say that is when you have a lot of resources, a lot of forces on the ground, it's good because it helps for security, but there's also a downside in that it sometimes inhibits partnership and empowering the Afghan units that are there, right? Because it's easy to say, hey, we have all these resources, we can control the territory, you know, let's do it ourselves. Why bother, you know, putting the Afghans into that role? Yet, if you are starting to see resources constrained and forces drawn down, you know, small is beautiful in those kinds of environments. You know, it forces you to partner and to push the Afghans into the lead because you just don't have the forces to do it by yourself. It's a catalyst for partnership, and it's in my mind is really the way forward because the Afghans really are going to be the end result here. I mean, we're going to succeed or fail based on what they're able to do after we withdraw.
Well, Fernando Luján, it's been good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
That's Fernando Luján. Again, he's a U.S. Army Special Forces major. He's been embedded with Afghan troops for the past 14 months. Jonathan Steele, I'd love your reaction to what we just heard from Major Luján. Can this war still be won, as he says? What do you think?
Well, I remember going in 1986 to places that I hadn't been able to go to in 1981 with Soviet escort, and they had made advances too. So it's not impossible to make advances if you put enough men and material in there and you're willing just to sit there and occupy. You can make the advances. The point is that at some point you can't. You have to leave. The Americans can't be there forever occupying the country just as the Russians did. And one of the things I do in my book is to confront many of the Western myths about Afghanistan. One of the biggest one is that the Soviet Union suffered a military defeat in Afghanistan. It didn't. It could have stayed there many, many more years, just as the Americans can stay many, many more years in Afghanistan if they want to. They also can't be defeated militarily. What happened was that the new leadership came in with Mikhail Gorbachev in 1985 and said, look, this is a stalemate. It's costing us far too much in terms of men and money, and there is no victory. They can't defeat us, we can't defeat them, but we have to find a political settlement. And that's the same in the situation now. So I don't deny all the things that Major Luján has been telling us, and it's very interesting, and no doubt there have been small advances here and there, but they don't change the big strategic picture. I mean, the military is very good at looking at tactics and claiming up advances here and there, and there is a kind of obligatory optimism if you're a military officer. You don't want to say we're doing badly. You're not allowed to say that in public, really. But the fact is the strategy is what's important. What is the strategy? You can't just occupy the country forever. And the Afghan National Army can't be built up ever into a sufficient force that will command respect and loyalty in the Pashtun areas unless the government for which it's working, the Afghan national government, has respect. And it doesn't because there is so much corruption at the local level as well as at the central level. And people, many areas trust the Taliban more in terms of justice. They feel that we get justice. It may be rather tough and summary justice on issues of dispute. If you go to the government when there's a problem of land or whatever it is, some civil issue or criminal case, you have to bribe judges and prosecutors and so on to get a hearing, let alone to get a judgment.
Well, I'd like to hear from both of you in the studio, too. What do you think, David Kilcullen? You're an expert in counterinsurgency. What do you think about the strategies that we heard from Major Luján about and his overall view that things are going well there, or it's starting to work?
Let me say first up that Nando's a friend of mine, and I'm, like all of us, very happy that he made it back safely from a particularly tough job in Afghanistan. I agree with everything Fernando said. I think that the Afghan army has developed very significantly in its capability in the last 2 or 3 years. I guess where I would come down on it, though, is that that doesn't actually matter as much in the long term as we would like it to. I think that unless you can translate that into a civilian government that actually has the respect of its population and can govern, as Jonathan was saying, then it only gets you so far. I guess I would differ very slightly from Jonathan on one minor point, which is that a lot of us have been saying there's no military solution here, we need to make peace. I'm actually wondering whether we're in a good position to make peace at this point. We've seen the collapse of the Afghan peace process in the last 2 weeks. President Karzai just signed a strategic cooperation agreement with India. The Pakistani national security establishment have played a very significant behind-the-scenes role in the Taliban. So on the one hand, I think we're not getting there on the civilian aspects of the war. We're doing very well in the military part, but we're just not translating that into the progress we need to get to a political solution on the ground in Afghanistan. But the bad news is we may also not be in a good position to just make peace. It's not as simple as saying there's no military solution, we just have to make peace. And I know Jonathan's not saying that, but I know other people have been saying that. And I think we actually have to recognize that maybe it's going to be a bit harder to negotiate a settlement than we might like to think.
Our number here on the Diane Rehm Show is 1-800-433-8850, 1-800-433-8850. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Your thoughts, too, General Barno, on this complicated situation that Major Lujan and Jonathan Steele and David Kilcullen are talking about. You know, military success is great, but it's not enough.
Well, I think one of the most important things Fernando said was that the absolute reality that ultimately this is going to be up to the Afghans themselves, that they're going to have to seize the banner here and move forward to defend their own country. The United States is going to give them capabilities to be able to do that. We're going to be resourcing their effort. We've assisted in training and growing and equipping their army in a dramatic fashion. That's going to be over 300,000 here, their army and their security forces, police forces, in the next couple of years. But ultimately, this is going to be decided by them. And that I'm not sure they've fully grasped what that means yet. And that means not only on the military side are they going to have to continue the fight, but as all of the participants here today have noted, the government is going to have to reform itself. It's going to have to change because it simply isn't acceptable in its current form with the degree of corruption that it's widely perceived and accurately perceived as being, a characteristic of the very fundamental part of the Afghan government in most places in the country. That's not sustainable.
Now, we haven't talked about the government of Hamid Karzai yet and how it's so often described as an unreliable partner for the United States.
Yeah, very, very difficult strategic partner, one that's become more so. And I would add, though, and I know President Karzai well, and I spent a lot of time with him when I was in Afghanistan for 19 months, that the U.S. has contributed to that in a sense by having absolutely no continuity in the leadership of our effort there. In the last 10 years, the United States has had 10 different military commanders for the operations in Afghanistan, and by my count, seven different U.S. ambassadors in a 10-year period. No university and no business could survive that kind of leadership turnover, but yet we're fighting a war in this way. So the Afghans are continually, one of the comments I hear from them occasionally in their leadership is, so many messengers, what's the message?
Well, that's interesting, and I haven't heard that before. So thanks for bringing that up. Let's go to our callers now. Again, the number 1-800-433-8850. And waiting in Lansing, Michigan is Matt. Hi, Matt. You're on the Diane Rehm Show. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Originally, I had a question about the historical context of this war, but unfortunately, that was answered a little while ago. So I have a different question for your panel now. I was wondering, we've talked a lot about, we've been there for 10 years so far, and I'm really wondering, what's the end game for the United States? Winning can mean very different things to different people. So I'm wondering, what would be a win in the eyes of your panelists?
Right.
And I'll take my comments up here.
Matt, it's a great question. And I do want to talk a little bit more about the historical context of that, because, again, Jonathan Steele, that's your book. You go through in great detail, and we won't do that now, but just some of the mistakes that the Soviets made and how the United States is repeating those same mistakes. Can you just give us a quick idea of what you're talking about there, Jonathan?
Well, I think it was the origins of the war were the real thing. I think this war began with the Russians in a mood of anger and revenge because they didn't like the leader in Kabul who'd murdered the previous president, who was much more close to Moscow and seemed a more reliable person. And so they came in with regime change, just as the Americans came in with anger and a sense of revenge after 9/11 and wanted to get rid of that regime. And the Russians did it very quickly, just as the Americans did. And then they thought it would be fine and we could pull out quite quickly. They didn't do the day two problem that we've already touched on. So that was the real thing. And mission creep came in, and what was meant to be a quick withdrawal turned into nation building. And as I said before, it just became an unending burden, and they decided to pull out. But they also had this big problem with Pakistan. I mean, Gorbachev asked for an assessment of what we do next, and one of his military advisors said, well, as long as you have an open border with Pakistan, there's nothing we can do because there's an endless supply of people coming across with training and money, and there's nothing we can do about it unless we put 250,000 men on the border, and that's unrealistic. It's exactly the same problem we have today. If Afghanistan was an island in the South Pacific, it would be different. But it's got this open border with Pakistan, and the Americans can never seal that border, even with all these drone attacks and everything else inside Pakistan, something the Russians never did. They're not going to seal the border, so that is the problem. But the difference, I think, is that, as I said, a new leader came in. Gorbachev, very much like Obama, he inherited a predecessor's war. He saw it was not working, and he changed strategy. What is really, I think, disappointing to me is that Obama came in and has tripled the number of troops there. Instead of saying we have to get out, he's actually gone much further in, and he's even now trying to negotiate what's called the Strategic Partnership Agreement, which will keep U.S. troops there indefinitely, not combat troops, but they'll be called advisors or trainers or logisticians or whatever else you want to disguise them as, but they still will be uniformed and armed. And it's an open-ended commitment, and I don't think the American public really wants that, according to all the polls.
Well, and maybe after a break, David, you can talk more about the surge and the impact of the surge. I also want to ask all of you about Matt's excellent question. What is the end game for the United States in Afghanistan? So we'll talk about that coming up. Also take your calls at 1-800-433-8850. Keep it right here.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now presenting a retrospective of Willem de Kooning, more at MoMA.org. From John and Catherine Debs, committed to advancing public understanding of America's energy needs and options. And by the Overbrook Foundation, supporting CatalogChoice.org, a nonprofit service that allows customers to decide which catalogs to receive in the mail. This is NPR.
Disappearing pensions. A Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist reveals how companies plunder and profit from employee pension plans. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Laura Kanoy, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking about the 10th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan today on the Diane Rehm Show, and welcoming your comments at 1-800-433-8850. And gentlemen, before we go back to the phones, I did want to follow up on something that Jonathan Steele said earlier. And David, that was about the surge, Obama's surge of, I believe it was 2009 when he announced it. What impact do you see that having, again, given your expertise as a counterinsurgency advisor to General David Petraeus?
Well, let me just clarify. I was not advising General Petraeus in Afghanistan.
Yes, but in Iraq.
In Iraq,
yes.
Yeah. I think the surge has had a number of rather good effects on the ground. We've seen a very significant level of damage to the southern and eastern Taliban in terms of their ability to operate on the ground. We've forced the enemy into what I would call a winter operating pattern. Normally in the summer they operate in guerrilla fashion in the countryside. In the winter they move into the cities and they adopt more of a terrorist bombing and assassination type of approach. We've made the countryside so difficult for them to operate in that they've actually started to target the cities more frequently over the last 6 months.
And we've sure seen that.
We've definitely seen that. One of my research team leads was actually stuck in the street for 6 hours outside the embassy compound in Kabul a few weeks ago when the the Taliban and Haqqani network attacked the ISAF headquarters. Now, that's an interesting example because one of the other problems with the surge is that when he announced the surge, the president unfortunately also said exactly how long it was going to last and exactly when we were going to leave. And that's had a very chilling effect on Afghan popular confidence. Your listeners probably know that the attack on the compound happened from a building that was half finished. What they may not know is that that building was being built as a hotel by an entrepreneur who stopped building it as soon as the president announced that we were going to leave in July 2011. And it's been sitting empty and abandoned ever since. And that is true of many construction projects across Afghanistan. A lot of people lost confidence when they realized that we were going to depart sometime after 2011. And I think this gets to Matt's question about what's the end game. I think we can talk a lot about what we want the end game to be, but I think if we look at the probabilities, we're going to muddle through to 2014. I don't think there's any significant likelihood of a major military defeat or a major breakthrough by the Taliban. I think the Taliban are basically locked out in a military sense. The problem is, what's going to happen after 2014.
All right, let's take some more calls, gentlemen. Yeah. And our number again, 1-800-433-8850. And Andrew's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Andrew. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Sure. Thanks for taking my call. I've been really encouraged in the past few years, actually, to hear folks at the military, including Admiral Mullen most recently, explain that what we're dealing with is an issue of the confidence of the Pakistanis and of the tribal elders and stuff in having the U.S. and having security be there for them. This is not an issue of ideological alliance with Taliban. But I think that narrative is not present in the American public's mind. I don't think that the media and politicians have really been conveying that narrative. It's been much less nuanced. It's been about bad guys. And I also wonder what is the degree to which our regular soldiers and our vets are thinking in the sort of terms of bad guys and ideology and our failure to convert people's minds versus the issue that people are having to be protectionist and maintain alliances with Taliban because, you know, they might, because they're going to be vulnerable to them down the line. What accounts for this disconnect and what's the impact as far as our vets while they're there and serving and when they come home?
Okay, Andrew, thanks a lot. And why don't you take that one, General Barno?
Well, that's a complicated question. I think the why the enemy fights, how the U.S. looks at that, whether everybody sees the same lens. I think it does bring in also the issue of Pakistan, which the caller noted. And that's just crucial to the end game in Afghanistan. Jonathan noted, Afghanistan is not an island. It's part of a region. Its next door neighbor is Pakistan. There are 30 million Afghans, but there are 187 million Pakistanis. By 2050, there's going to be 300 million Pakistanis next door. It's the second largest Islamic country in the world, and they have somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 nuclear weapons. So if we think about U.S. vital interests in that part of the world, and increasingly we're going to have to think about how we transition our presence there and still protect these vital interests, Pakistan, you know, comes to center stage here. And unfortunately, if you take a circle and say one circle is U.S. interests in the region and another circle is Pakistan's interests, those circles only overlap a bit. They're not synonymous. The U.S. interests and Pakistani interests are not the same. So the Pakistanis are making decisions and they're taking actions with regard to Afghanistan in a way that advances their interests to protect their back door, as they see it, from Indian influence. Their number one worry is not terrorism. It's not Al-Qaeda. It's India. And India is a 1.2 billion population nation next door that they fought 3.5 wars with and lost each one, and to include losing half of their country. They're desperately worried that Afghanistan will become an Indian entree into their back door. And so a lot of what they're doing is rightly or wrongly, is trying to ensure that they've got the ability to influence events in Afghanistan, apparently through the Taliban, in an era where the United States is not going to be present in as much force, if present at all.
Well, and General Barno, since you mentioned it, I do have a couple emails and Twitter messages from our listeners, including Tom in Uxbridge, Massachusetts, who says, I would love to hear your panel discuss the implications of Afghanistan's recent treaty with India. Can you go into that a little bit? I mean, it's not that far afield from what we're talking about.
Right. That's breaking news here, of course, in the last 48 hours that President Karzai has signed some type of a strategic partnership agreement with India. In many ways, this is Pakistan's ultimate nightmare. They do not want to see an Afghan state on their western border that's allied with India, that potentially could, in the Pakistani viewpoint at least, pose a threat to surround Pakistan on both the east and the west with Indian influence. So this is going to be problematic, but I also think, once again, it reflects the Afghans starting to hedge their bets against the day after the Americans are gone.
Well, and Jonathan Steele, to you again, what sort of relations did the Soviet Union have with Pakistan vis-a-vis Afghanistan? And is the United States repeating what the Soviet Union did there or not?
Well, I think it's quite similar because, as I said earlier, Pakistan was supporting the Mujahideen fighting against the Soviet Union. Of course, Pakistan had the backing of the West and Saudi Arabia and China as well because they were also supporting the Mujahideen. But the negotiations that finally were achieved in April 1988 in Geneva involved the government of Pakistan and the government of Afghanistan and the U.S. and the USSR, as it then was. And so Pakistan is absolutely crucial. But, I mean, I think it was President Obama, at least as a candidate, I'm not sure if he repeated it in the early months of his presidency, that said the real key to this is Kashmir. I mean, we have to solve the problem of Kashmir because that is really the source of Indo-Pakistan tension, a huge border dispute about who controls Kashmir. So I think that's where you have to look for a solution. But the end game that I would like to see is an independent, sovereign Afghanistan with a functioning government and with no foreign troops of any kind and with a compact with all its regional neighbors, Iran as well as Pakistan, India as well, China, the Central Asian states, who would agree finally to stop using it as a pawn in a great game that would not try to interfere in its internal affairs and dominate its government and so on. And I think that's really the end game that we would like to see. But it does involve, as I said, not having foreign troops and therefore this strategic partnership agreement that Ryan Crocker, the ambassador, is trying to negotiate right now, sabotages all that because you cannot have a non-aligned country with large numbers of foreign troops. The Taliban and the other insurgents will never negotiate as long as they feel there isn't an absolute zero withdrawal, I mean, a 100% withdrawal with zero troops left behind. And so that really, to my mind, is the crucial thing at this point, that President Obama has to absolutely say publicly, we are committed to negotiations, we recognize this is a stalemate, and we will withdraw all our troops by the end of 2014, not just the combat troops, but all troops, and we will use what leverage we have in the remaining 3 years to try and broker a government of national unity in Kabul that will include all the groups, including the Taliban and the Haqqani network and all the rest of it, so that the civil war, which is essentially there underneath the foreign intervention, can also end.
Well, and I want to turn our attention, gentlemen, to how Americans feel about this 10th anniversary. Here's an email from Kurt in Illinois. He says, how is a very poor country like Afghanistan going to pay all the police and soldiers we are training? Is the assumption that the U.S. taxpayer will pay them indefinitely through some part of the Pentagon's budget? Kurt, thanks for that. And David, I'll turn to you on that, not only for his specific question, but more just, we hear about, you know, war fatigue here in this country. We're tired of the bad headlines. We're tired of our soldiers being killed. And we're tired of paying these enormous bills. So go ahead, David.
Well, 2 points. One on U.S. popular opinion. And I think this tracks rather well with a lot of other countries that are involved in Afghanistan as well. Most people, when asked, what do you think about Afghanistan, are extremely negative. But when you ask people, what's your top five or six list of big issues, Afghanistan isn't at the top of that list. It comes after employment and the economy and, you know, the possible future problems associated with Social Security and so on. It's down there in the list, and that's true of most countries. So I don't think it's a vote changer or necessarily a public opinion issue that's at the same level as, say, Iraq was back in 06, 07, based on most of the polling that I've seen. The issue about, you know, what happens from here. And
right. Do we keep paying these bills even after we're gone?
So right now the war's costing us about $108 billion a year. most of the estimates say that to continue running the Afghan government's military forces as they currently are structured after we leave would be somewhere in the order of $2 to $5 billion a year. So that's a lot of money. It's still a hell of a lot cheaper than what we're doing right now. There's been a lot of effort put into thinking about things like the so-called New Silk Road Initiative, some various agricultural and mining initiatives to try to find a viable approach for Afghanistan to pay for itself. I would, however, say that that's not as critical as some people think. Afghanistan's what we call a rentier state. It has been for 150 years. It's the nature of Afghanistan in the region. it hasn't been subject to a massive civil war for the last 150 years. There are other factors involved than its economic basis. We can come to stability through, as Jonathan says, some form of national reconciliation much more easily than through somehow pitchforking Afghanistan into the 21st century economically. I don't think that that's necessarily the best way to do it. I guess where I part ways a little bit with people is in the belief that it is actually possible to achieve this very nice outcome that we've been talking about. There is a very substantial element in the Afghan population that is not going to sit down under a government of national unity that includes the Taliban. The northern ethnic groups are not going to do that. And there is even a substantial portion of the Pashtun population that's not going to do that. And I think we're looking at the potential for a very substantial civil war the size of Iraq in 2006. If we're not careful here.
Well, and thanks for that email, Kurt. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Again, looking at the reaction to the 10th anniversary of Afghanistan in this country, General Barno, what about the presidential election? How do you hear these candidates for president talking about the Afghan war?
Well, it's actually rather remarkable how little conversation's been held on that. I mean, even in the debates that the Republican candidates have had so far, looking at the administration, as Dave Kilcullen points out, most Americans don't have this in their top three or top five, in a lot of cases, a list of things that are important to them. I think that, in a way, reflects the fact that this is the first prolonged war that's been fought by the all-volunteer force, that you had a group of volunteers, including members of my family, who've been out there fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq for the last 10 years, but the majority of the American public, the other 99.5% of our population, really hasn't been involved with this. And so the reality of how this plays out politically in the upcoming election is uncertain right now, but to date we've seen almost no discussion of it at all, which is really striking given that we have 100,000 Americans, you know, leaving the front gate of their compounds daily and going into combat in Afghanistan.
Well, and given the price tag that David just outlined for us too, $100 billion a year, I think, is what you said roughly, David.
A little
right?
more than that.
So,
yeah.
Right. So I do read about in the political press a growing anti-war trend in the GOP base. Certainly when Ron Paul talks about let's get everybody out and let's get them out now, he gets big cheers, General Barno. What do you think?
Well, fiscal austerity is here, and it's here to stay, I think, for the United States. You know, in fact, our think tank is releasing a report that I'm co-authoring tomorrow coming out, looking at responsible defense, how to make hard choices in an era of fiscal austerity. And we're going to see less government money available for all sorts of services, but also including the Defense Department. And so looking at those dollars we're spending in Afghanistan is going to be part of that. But ultimately, we have to decide where are our vital national interests around the world? How do we continue to protect them? And what choices do we make in our ability to do that? Where do we take risk? Where do we invest more? Is the future going to be more about Asia and less about Europe? How do we set that up in a way that makes sense, given that we're not going to have as many dollars to spend?
Well, here's a comment from Facebook that I want to share with all of you, and I think I'll throw it to you, Jonathan Steele. This person says, when I lived in Afghanistan from 1968 to 71, the Loya Jirga system still functioned at the village level, even under the king. It worked. Why did we not embrace the Loya Jirga governance system and then eliminate the warlords? Is the answer as simple as we insist on imposing governments in our image? Could you, when you answer it, Jonathan, also just talk briefly about what Loya Jirga is, in case some people don't remember what that is?
Well, Loya Jirga is a kind of council or consultation at different levels. It can be, as the questioner said, at the local level, or it can be provincial level. And recently we've had two or three at the national level. In fact, Karzai was appointed initially by an emergency Loya Jirga in 2002. And we've had another thing called the Peace Jirga a year ago, which set up the High Peace Council that was supposed to deal with dialogue and the question of talks and so on. So it is a very good idea. It is obviously a little bit dominated traditionally by local elders. It's very male, and mullahs and clerical people come in as well. So it's not really suited to a more evolving, modernizing, urbanizing society, especially one where you're trying to bring on the rights of women. But it is respected by many Afghans, and they see it as something positive and of their own, and not a sort of Western import.
And Jonathan, you described earlier your end game, your ideal picture for where Afghanistan could be. No foreign troops on the ground. Afghanistan is not used as a pawn by its neighbors. It's peaceful. It's stable. David Kilcullen said he does think that that vision can be achieved. I wonder real quickly, Jonathan, what do you think?
Well, I'm actually quite pessimistic because I think the murder of former President Rabbani 2 weeks ago was a real blow, not because he was actually involved. He was head of the High Peace Council, but not because he was really involved operationally in talks. I think he was just doing a lot of visits and things, but not really substantial talks. The more important thing was he was one of the highest profile ethnic Tajiks in Kabul, and it's raised suspicions between the Tajiks and the Pashtuns, so I'm quite pessimistic about that. The very fracturing of all the insurgent groups between the Haqqani, the Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, the Taliban itself is no longer centrally controlled as it was in the earlier period.
All right,
it makes
and Jonathan,
it very hard
just,
to get things going.
Yeah. Let me just jump in. David, did I misspeak there? You are optimistic or you're not optimistic?
No, not particularly optimistic.
You're not optimistic.
No, I
apologize.
I think it's relatively unlikely that we're going to get to that political settlement.
Really? All right, well, we'll end it on that, gentlemen. I really appreciate you coming in, sharing your visions for what might happen on this 10th anniversary. Jonathan Steele, good to have you. Thank you very much for your time.
I enjoyed it. Good.
Jonathan Steele, author of the forthcoming book, Ghosts of Afghanistan. And General Barno, it was nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Laura, great to meet you.
That's David Barno. He's a senior advisor at the Center for New American Security. And David Kilcullen, good to have you, too.
Thanks,
Thank
Laura.
You. I'm Laura Kanoy, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we are on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.